eventually you get to be long in the tooth to be a student organizer. I started late after grad school and had done it for 2.5 years. I had a nice lucrative gig in Arkansas, did some speaking engagements and got a $1,000 check and decided that I was going to use that $1,000 to start a new life. So I went on, of course, I went on an epic road trip. And I visited my girlfriend at the time in Huntsville, Alabama, and caught a ride with her brother to Texas. And then I think in Texas, I caught a ride with some other friends who had been on a road trip. And we all gathered, my brother and his partner and some other friends. And we had this cool camp out in Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument in Arizona on the Mexican border. And we camped out and I was with two couples, you know, so I felt like I was just kind of a fifth wheel and I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I'd been on the road for years and didn't want to just kind of be, go on the permanent road trip tour. My brother at this point was on this 2.5 year trip with he and his partner where they stayed in all of the bioregions of the West. And they really got to deeply know and understand North America by going and living in every bioregion for months at a time, just by hitchhiking and being careful with their expenses. They had this. And so I hung out with them and got to see the desert. And we did a lot of rock climbing and bouldering in canyons and hung out with climbing bums and had some adventure. But I decided to get off on my own. And so I crossed over into Mexico and I got a bus to Tijuana. And then I crossed over the border from Tijuana into San Diego. And then I took a Greyhound because I didn't want to hitchhike through LA, which is a giant cluster. And I got to Santa Barbara. Well, when I was on the Greyhound to Santa Barbara, I had met this teenage runaway who had been, I think she was 16, and she was from Iowa, and she had gotten snatched up by the police and sent home to Iowa. So she just took some money from her mom's purse and climbed out the bedroom window and bought a bus ticket and was on her way back to her boyfriend in Santa Barbara. And so she introduced me to the Santa Barbara beach bum community, and I decided that I would kind of do this sociological experiment and I would just be homeless for a while and hang out in paradise. And it was really informative. You know, I do some work with the homelessness, and that week of kind of hanging out with the homeless folks and being a beach bum was enlightening. You know, it's like a full-time job. You know, you got to carry your stuff everywhere. You got to walk across town to get to the free breakfast place. And then you got to find a place to safe place to be able to spend the night. Spent one night on the beach, but then I met some, I'd met these other guys who found some private land where they said that the landowner didn't mind if you pitched a tent. And so we'd go pitch our tent and take it down. And I just hung out and, blew through money, because homeless people can sense, the guy who's got a little held back, ended up blowing through most of my money pretty quick there. And I decided I'd better get moving. And it had been like 6 weeks since I'd had a shower, since I'd left my girlfriend's brothers in Texas, and I'd been a long bus trip in Mexico and weeks of camping. And so it was like a sunny day. And so I got out in the Pacific and then the sun went behind the clouds and it got cold and I never drowned. I kind of dropped my core temperature and I was just cold and miserable. And I realized that I wasn't on vacation anymore, that I was homeless and it was pretty miserable. So I started hitchhiking north. I stayed off Highway 1, which was a mistake, and tried to go up 101 had trouble getting rides. And I was, this guy pulled over in a pickup truck. And I said, "Hey, where are you going?" He's like, "Farther than you are now." So I took him for a ride, and his name was Workman. And he was this really cool guy, and he had this bit of a Jesus delusion, maybe, or maybe he was Jesus, or maybe he was just someone living like Jesus. But he lived in this converted school bus that he'd made into a camper, and he dumpster dove his food, and he was a sign painter, and he had traded a painted a sign at a junkyard for the chance to park his bus there for a month. And then he was going around painting signs, mostly in Spanish. And he was teaching himself Spanish as he's worked his way south, because his eventual plan was to get to the equator, because he liked the idea of being at, longitude or latitude? 0 degrees was his goal. So he was on his way to Quito, Ecuador, or thereabouts. And so he was amazing. I mean, a real humble, spiritual guy. And I painted some signs with him and hung out for a few days. And he offered to let me stay on his bus, and he would get me in a vehicle, and he would teach me the art of sign painting, and we would learn Spanish together. And he would do things like, well, name anything. And I would name whatever I was hungry for. And he would pull it out of the dumpster, or he would pull it out of his dried stocks of, he was on a fruit fast, and he kept finding a bunch of meat and drying it, you know. So he would, anything I could think of, he could cook by what he had in his bus or what he could go pull out of a dumpster right now, you know. And so we just had a great time. And I had been planning on visiting my friend Jim Squatter, who was this anarchist, super activist who had broken his neck and had come to the last Fermi protest in 1995, the year after the big one that I told the story about, and helped organize some protests. And so I had planned on seeing him, and I wanted to check out, the whole plan was I wanted to check out UNC Santa Cruz and think about getting into a PhD program, because I didn't really want to go to work and didn't know what I wanted to do. And I thought, well, PhD in sociology would be more useful than a master's degree in sociology. And they had the best social movements department. So, but I called Squatter to let him know that I was going to be a little bit longer and maybe not coming at all, because I was intrigued by Lance Workman's Live Like Jesus Right Now style of living, of just kind of humbly being a random force for good and living modestly off people's waste. And Squatter's dad had died, and he needed someone to watch his lizard and take care of his place so he could go back for the funeral. And so I parted from Workman and told, you know, we exchanged some letters, and I never really made it back down to be able to find him again. Because I got to Squatter's, and you know, he gets that name because he lived in squats in San Francisco. And if you see that Michelle Shock album where she's being dragged off by the police, Squatter was the one who organized the protest that she got arrested on. And it was cool because Michelle Shock would like call the house, and because she was still friends with Squatter. So he was all in on the local activist scene and had been a big protester, but he had broken his neck and had become kind of a cannabis activist because it helped with his muscle spasticity. And he walked, even though he had a broken neck. He was supposed to be, you know, he had some quadriplegia, but he got movement and got himself to walk through force of will and cannabis. And so he introduced me to Debbie Goldberry with the Cannabis Action Network. And that was in 1996, when they had just working towards the end of collecting signatures for the medical marijuana initiative, Prop 215. And so I ended up, I tried to get a job as a lobbyist for a highway safety organization, and that fell through. And so even though at the time cannabis reform was about 99 on my list of 100 most important issues, you know, I like to smoke weed and I found it to be good, and I didn't like the drug war, but there were a lot of other problems that seemed more immediate and important to me, but it was significant. And so but mostly I needed a job. And so CAN had a great model of, they had a communal house. Debbie had started the group. They did tabling on Telegraph Avenue. Plus, they also did tabling on rock concerts. And they sold hemp products and information about marijuana and hemp. And they also did some other organizing. And so Debbie had never had anybody come into CAN who had previous organizing experience. And she had done a lot of stuff and was a great organizer, but I had done a lot of stuff and was a great organizer. And so we ended up working really well together, and we got into a place where we were coordinating the statewide grassroots effort for, we started the PAC Friends of Prop 215 with some group of activists, and we were real leaders on this statewide movement. And we worked with the big money activists who were formed by, you know, George Zimmer from Men's Warehouse and George Soros. So it's funny when you always hear about professional protesters. And so I was an agent of Soros. I remember going and, you know, going to George Men's Warehouse and picking up a $5,000 check, and we got some funding. And so they spent a lot of money on advertising, and mostly we kept the grassroots activists out of the media, and we focused on some basic politics of voter registration and get out the vote activities, and we harnessed that grassroots energy, and we won. We raised more money. We did a stealth campaign because the big money people didn't put their money in until late, and by the time that the preventionists and the cops started trying to do their organizing, they never caught up to us, and we passed it, and it changed the world. And that was funny. Even as we were working towards it, we didn't know if it would create a positive defense for people who were charged, or if it would be a law that would really work, because it was a new model. Rather than be in conflict with federal law, it didn't touch federal law at all, and it just said, you shall be exempted from state penalties and doctors shall not be punished for making recommendations. And it created this system of legal protections, but without, and the state shall build a framework. But they, the day after it passed, everybody started opening up pot clubs, and my friends who had been activists, suddenly started to make a lot of money. So while I was there, I had been struggling with depression, you know, when you're living in poverty and you have a transitory lifestyle, there's a lot of stresses to that. And I had been depressed and not even kind of realized it. And then hanging out, we went to this Renaissance festival, and a friend of mine gave me this hit of ecstasy, MDMA. And it really, blew my mind. It lightened it, and it gave me this kind of happiness hangover for a number of days, and it reminded me what it was like to feel joyful and to feel really good. And I had forgotten and had been kind of going through the motions in life, even with all of these adventures and amazing experiences. I would not say that I was super happy most of the time. And so I started to do that, and use, you know, when you're a drug policy reform activist, you end up having to use a lot of drugs. And I had been pretty moderate in my use, but I started to use massive doses of the highest quality cannabis and cannabis extracts, and then supplementing that with MDMA on the weekends. And so that was lifestyle, you know. It was there through the spring and summer and into the fall. We passed the election. It was pretty euphoric. And then we had this 3-week trip to Amsterdam, where Debbie had this standing gig where she, a week of it, for the Cannabis Cup, which is the international pot growing championships of the world, that they would host in Amsterdam. And she would work security, and her friends, and her boyfriend was a guitar tech for a Fishbone, and they always played in Amsterdam during Cannabis Cup. So she would go a week early and then party and hang out and have fun, and then work for a week, and then stay a week after. So it was a 3-week trip, and I was a little tight on money and almost didn't go, but they really talked me into going and said it would be fine, that I would have a good time. And we went, and we stayed at this mind spa, and this guy who must have been involved in the international drug trade, because there were no customers to this building, and it didn't like it was used, but he had all of this. He had like a sensory deprivation tank that we tried out, and he had these things called synchrotech machines that were syncopated light and sound that were supposed to generate psychedelic experiences. And went and stayed and ate good food and went to the clubs and smoked. And we did everything that we were doing, which was a lot, and we turned it up a degree. And so one night, Aaron, who is the person I was hanging out with the most, he had gotten this stuff called whatever, organic ecstasy, some MDMA or some variant. And so he talked to me into doing it. We stayed up all night doing ecstasy. The next night, talked me into it again. We stayed up all night doing ecstasy. And then some flip in my mind switched and I didn't need to do ecstasy anymore. It was like being high all the time. And in what, looking back on it, it was this manic breakdown. And I began to have this just this incredible psychedelic experience. I didn't sleep. From what I've been able to put together, I think this was about a week into the trip, and I didn't sleep again for the entire trip. I was afraid that if I tried to sleep, if I closed my, that people would be whispering in my ears and trying to hypnotize me. And so I had a number of experiences, and I started to, I don't want to get too much into the details of it, but I came to believe that when I had one bag when we had gone to Amsterdam, and so I had carried a friend's bag with me, and so we hadn't talked about it, but there was this expectation, since she came with three bags and I came with one bag and you were allowed two bags, that I would be carrying one of these bags back. And there were these plates of hash, you know, that were CD sized and being dipped in wax the night before we left. And I knew that part of that had been in that box was these fishbone CDs that we had brought over. And then I came to believe that I was going to be in, that this was some kind of initiation into some kind of psychedelic drug smuggling gang, or I was having some kind of delusional experience. There's really no way to know. But I had the bag, and we were going out on the trip and in the train, and I'm moving sluggish because I haven't slept in 2 weeks, and I just started to feel a little bit tired, and I didn't make it out of the doors with the bags when we got to the train, and the train left the airport, and I rode out to the next, and I didn't know what to do because I felt like there was a good chance that one of those bags was filled with perhaps millions of dollars of hash. And I know that they're decriminalized drugs in Amsterdam, but not suitcases full of them. And so there were some people behind me who were going to the airport, and I thought that the only people that I could trust would be random people. And so I poured my story out to this random girl who was standing behind me because I didn't allow her to get off the train and miss the door. And she said, you know, if I got separated from my friends, they would wait for me at the airport. So if they're there when you get there, you can know that you're your friends and you can trust them. And that seemed like real good advice. And I got there and my friends were long gone. And not only were they long gone, so was my plane ticket. And I knew that I had had it, you know. And so I started to wonder, and so I didn't know what to do. And so I walked out to the airport, and there was this this pile driver, this giant thing, and it was doing this rhythmic thing. And I had been kind of obsessed with like the power of techno music to hypnotize and consider that. And I was felt drawn to this, and I felt like there was this cosmic confrontation that was coming, and had wondered about the host of the Mind Spa and what was his involvement, because, you know, there were some cryptic things that had come up, and I had read Gravity's Rainbow by Pynchon, which ironically has this character named Rocket Man who finds himself stumbling upon a giant pile of hash and stumbling across Europe. And it's this classic paranoid conspiracy novel, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning, the best paranoid conspiracy. And I'm living this storyline out of this novel, and one of the people who got me to go on the trip had given it to me to read. And so I'm putting all these things together, some of which are, I don't know what's true and what's not, even to this day. So I'm sending out a bus. I fought the urge to go to this construction site based on this rhythmic pile driver. And I'm sitting at the bus stop, and I just decided that I pulled a bag of personal effects out of the bag, and I just left it at the bus stop, and I walked away. When I would get emotionally overwhelmed or in trouble, sometimes I would go hitchhiking, because the day-to-day struggle to where you're going to eat, how you're going to keep yourself safe, where you're going to lay your head tonight was very centering, you know, when you get into this primal quest for survival. So I walked away from the airport and walked down on the highway and put my thumb out, and I started to walk. And as I walked, I started to think if I was mic'd or bugged or what was going on. And so I started throwing away things like lighters that I had picked up at the Mind Spa, you know, and I had but it was all clogged up because I had been chain smoking. Because when you get mentally fractured, nicotine is a powerful focusing drug. So when you'd smoke a cigarette, I have this moment of clarity and being able to organize my thoughts for just a brief moment. But I had smoked all my cigarettes, and I had used this progressive relaxation technique to fight my migraines, and it had become part of my spiritual practice of breathing in through my nose, out through my mouth, slowly and deeply. And I had done a lot of this as an act, but I couldn't do that because my nose had been clogged up. I finally just kind of blew the snot on my nose and took a deep breath, and I felt this rush of power and energy, and I felt my spiritual form, and I realized that I was 10,000 feet tall, and that I was that my spiritual self was powerful, and that I could call down any powers that I needed to make anything happen that I needed to happen. And I didn't know why, that I either had broken through into this place of being able to wield magic, or I was some cosmic spirit that had this power. And I just said, and I was tired of walking, and I was frustrated, and I said, I whisper when I want to hypnotize, and I shout when I want something. And I said, if I don't get a ride right now, I will destroy Philip Morris, because I was blaming tobacco for my inability to breathe. And instantly there was this van that was in the far left lane, and it flew through four lanes of traffic and pulled over and stopped. And I got in, and it was a woman who looked just like my mom. And I just felt this great sense of calm. And I immediately spilled my guts about what was going on and I didn't know what to do. And so she drove me up a ways, and she pulled off an exit, and she drew me a map about how to get to Denmark or Belgium or something through back ways where I wouldn't have to go through customs, and felt that I would be safer leaving from another country if I was, you know, had been involved in this. And then she gave me 100 guilders and made me promise not to spend it on drugs, and sent me on my way. And so I went, and I had a series of adventures that I won't go into the details, because this is a story that's worthy of its own. So I ended up going back to the mind spa, and the dude was there, and I asked him if anybody had called or said anything or left my plane ticket, and he offered for me to come in, that we could come and work it out. And then I thought, well, that was the whole plan of this, of taking my plane ticket, you know, because I knew I didn't lose it. I had checked it and it was in my backpack, and then it wasn't, you know, so I know that it had been taken, or I was reasonably certain of, I wasn't certain of anything at that point, but I felt like that was what had happened. And I said, no, I'm going to stay with friends. And I went, and I called some people that I had met at various parties through having these weird conversations, because I was pretty spun, and didn't get a hold of anybody. And then I had this 100 guilders. I did buy a pack of cigarettes, and I felt bad because I had promised her I wouldn't buy any drugs. But, you know, it was any port in a storm. And so I bought a phone card, and I called my mom, because she looked like my mom. And my mom said, we'll get to the airport and we will get you a plane ticket. And they took out a loan. It was a lot of money. My parents bought me a plane ticket, because she had gotten, and I'm so glad I called, because when I wasn't at the airport and they had Mike disappeared, he was acting weird, telling my brother who lived at the CAN office. And when they came back without me, he had called my mom that, you know, Mike's missing in Europe. It was funny because I almost did a journey to the East and was going to hitchhike around the entire world and come back to North America from the other side. But then I decided instead to call my mom. So that ended up being a pretty transformative thing. So they bought me an airline ticket. My dad, I didn't have a pencil, because, oh, one thing I did before I left the bus station, you know, I went to the train station, I checked everything, all of my stuff in a locker, and I felt like I had heard a story about somebody else who had been caught with drugs leaving Amsterdam, and I felt like that maybe somebody had planted drugs on them, and I didn't know about all my stuff. I knew they had taken my plane ticket, and so I took all of my stuff, and I checked it into a locker, and then I bought the key, and then I took the key, and then I threw the key in the garbage can. And the only thing I kept was my wallet, because my dad had ingrained in me to hold on to my wallet as a lifelong lesson, and I held on to my passport. And so I didn't have a pencil, because I didn't know what was bugged, or if people were listening, you know, or if I was engaged in this kind of spiritual transformation, and it unleashed and awoken some kind of spiritual power. And so my dad, through a series of mnemonics, taught me to memorize in all of my scattered state this confirmation number to be able to pick up my... so he did it by breaking it into chunks and having, you know, he made up a mnemonic, and I think it was MCH, Mickey Call Home, and it went on to some numbers, and he was able to relate those numbers to things that I did, and they learned me that. So I got my ticket, and as I got on KLM Airport, which the guy who owned the Mind Spa was a heir to the KLM fortune, from what I had understood, and so I was wondering about this international conspiracy of airline people, and what was going on with that. And as I was getting on the plane, I felt like the flight attendant had given me an eye, and I took a right, and I went into the, and I climbed up, went into first class, and sat down and drank the champagne and mimosas and ate a nice meal, and went to the captain's restroom and put on his cologne, and I felt like I owned, you know, like I was. And then I come to find out I really didn't have a courtesy flight with total all access. This was before 9/11, and so a really big flight attendant, you know, who was like a bodybuilder flight attendant type, walked me back to the class that I was supposed to be in, apparently. But it was funny because my ticket, the seat didn't exist, you know, because I have my ticket and I'm pulling it out and I'm looking at it. And so all of these kind of disconnects and reality warps, you know, it's something I realize when you go insane, you don't just go insane. The universe goes insane, or maybe the universe is always insane and you just wake up to be able to see it. And, but I sat down and I talked to a guy, and everything that everybody said fed into this delusional reality. And I had read a lot of stuff, and I had the capacity to develop this amazingly complex and robust kind of delusional reality on almost everything. And when I got back home, I'm walking through customs. I don't have any luggage, you know. So they pulled me out for special screening, and they search, and they had done the same thing in the Netherlands, because I gave, you know, I couldn't answer the questions right. You know, everything had too much meaning and I was too scattered. But so they had given me a search and a once over and didn't find anything, put me on the plane. So they gave me a search and a once over, and lo and behold, they find four hits of LSD in my wallet, which I distinctly remember pulling. I used to carry LSD in my wallet, but I distinctly remember pulling them out and leaving them at my dresser at home. But man, it looked like those four squares that I had left over of this bad acid that I had bought from my housemate, Kurt. And so they gave me a ticket, which turned out to be good. And I got out, and I kind of expected everything to be over, but this whole kind of weirdness followed me. There were a lot of ominous things. There was this comic book laying in my bed in my parents' house from the stranger, and it had this thing about this guy who had got hypnotized to carry a bomb onto a plane that he thought was a box of chocolates. And I swear to fucking God, that comic book is laying open, folded over in my room. There was Stephen King's The Green Mile, you know, it came out as a serial book, you know, it was six little novelettes, and they were laying out in the room. And then as time went on, corners of them were starting to chew like they were being eaten by mice. And then I looked the next day and more of it was gone. And so I felt like this compelling reason that I had to read this book, and it was all this stuff about laying on of hands and spiritual experience that all seemed really powerful, because, you know, I was sleeping a couple hours a night and waking up bright and alert and rapid speech and not able to control myself. And I started to write poetry. I had a creative writing class and knew kind of the technique. I read a lot of poetry, but suddenly poetry started to spill out of me and I could write it at will on any subject. And I was writing sonnets in like 5 minutes with the right meter and rhyme scheme. But I couldn't harness it. I was all scattered, but I started writing stuff in notebooks and there was just so many things that objectively really happened, you know? And like at some points, you know, because everyone's telling me that I'm disturbed and that there's something wrong with me, and they're trying to get me to accept that I need to go help and go to the mental health agency that I used to work at, but I'm doubting it. But I saw this flutter and this light by the window, and I thought, well, maybe I am delusional and I'm having this experience. And I went and I opened this window, but it was a bird that had gotten behind the storm window, and there's a bird flying around the house. And I was delusional about the airlines, and then an airplane crashed in Ida, the town that I'm from, about 15 miles from where I was at. And then I had gotten this concern about this mental health agency. And then all the mental health agency people in the airport are on TV doing press conferences about how they're doing the support for the people who died in the plane crash. And right before the plane crashed, I'd felt like I had been compelled that I should paint, and I didn't want to paint. And then I turned on the TV and this airplane crashed, and I felt like it was done to punish me for not doing this thing. So I had all of this craziness, and it just kept accelerating. And ultimately my sister got me to go out to the mental health agency, and I scared the person who was doing the assessment because I was too demonstrative and I'm a big guy and I'm waving my arms around. So she called the police and they took me to the psychiatric unit that I used to work at, Pineview. And I stood in the sign-in room that I had gone down and talked people into voluntarily signing in by, if you don't sign in, they're going to commit you. And but the mental health agency came through for me, and they paid to send me to a hospital in a nearby community. So I only had to work with four of my former colleagues instead of 30 or 40 of them at the unit that. And so I signed myself in because I knew the process because I had worked in it, and I was not convinced that I could act sane in front of a judge for a half an hour. And so I signed myself in. And I stayed for 2 weeks, and it was a really enlightening experience. You know, I think anyone who works on a psychiatric unit, if they get a chance to experience what it's like from the other side of the counter, it can be really powerful, because I had no idea the deep shame of being there, of not having your thoughts work, of feeling judged, of people implying or telling you that you're crazy. But I also had this, you know, I was articulate and passionate, and my thoughts were working very quickly, and I had this great knowledge base. So I was, you know, so right away, as I talked to people, about half the people who are on a psychiatric unit don't want to be there. And so I started talking to the people who didn't want to be there. And I'm like, oh, man, if you don't want to be here, it's easier to get out. Just call your insurance company and tell them that you don't want to be here. Because as soon as your insurance stops paying, they don't keep you. There are these little sheets that they put on the front of the chart that say what date your insurance runs out. And before it goes out, they either let you go or they call and get more time. And nobody, no matter what problems they have, ever get to stay one more day than their insurance will pay. And so the people got on the phone and they called their insurance company, and then they're packing their bags and leaving. And so I got there and I discharged half the unit right before Christmas. And then staff are getting sent home because they have low census days. And there was this big resentment because I knew how all their bullshit worked, and I would call them out on it. And I was filled with this sense of justice. This guy had told me about these witches who were at this Detroit mental hospital, and I believed him, and I'm asking him on the details. And then as we talked, I said, you know, I just figured out because I was this wildly empathetic that I said, they're really not witches. They're just people who were really mean to you, weren't they? And he's crying and he's like, yeah. And we had this breakthrough. And one of my old colleagues, this guy who had been through college on football scholarship and was not a very helpful guy, I noticed he had changed, and he had become this really kind of great listener and supportive guy, and he was actually really good. And just when I had worked with him just a few years ago, you know, he was a piece of shit employee, you know, who just wanted to play foosball and get through his thing. And, you know, he wasn't mean to people, but he didn't go out of his way to help. And now he was this really excellent clinician. And there was this kind of wise old mental health advocate who had been doing it for like 20 years. And he was really funny and really engaging and could meet you where you were at. And no matter, and I, even though I was kidding, we played foosball, but we used to not let the patients play because none of them, they weren't good. You know, the people, if you play the foosball, you have to work there to get really good at it, you know. So it would be like the guy who ran our unit loved foosball, and he'd grab the three best players and we play foosball while the poor nurse had have to do all the work. And the patients never got to play because they were never any good. But he, you know, they played with the patients, and he was really validating. And I saw that there's just kind of magic about his approach. And there were some other mental health patients that I just bonded with in a powerful way. This poet who was there, and we would talk and write poetry, and he shared his broadsheet with me. And had a girl I was flirting with, and so I had actually it was a transformative time. I got on this medication called risperidone, this antipsychotic, which got me sleeping every night, and I started to pull my thoughts together, and I was only sleeping for 3 or 4 hours, but I was sleeping every night, and I left 2 weeks a little bit more pulled together, but still pretty delusional. And all of these even more weird things continued to happen that I couldn't understand. And this happened in November, and in April of the following year, I was sitting there, and I was thinking about all that had happened, and I thought, for the first time, well, maybe I'm just crazy, you know, maybe this is just what people are saying it is, and it, because I was mixed up of whether I was caught up in an international conspiracy of people who were trying to blow my mind, some kind of Illuminati style trickster CIA psychedelics thing, or was I having this spiritual experience where I was coming into my personal spiritual power in a positive way? And then I had this third possibility, well, maybe I'm just crazy. And I made a list, and I was able to identify like 10 or 12 things that were objectively real and fundamentally super weird and high, you know, an amazing set of like the airplane crash and a bunch of other things that I knew for a fact had happened, that and I made this list, and I thought, I might never know what's going to happen, but I know that I was a lot happier when I thought that the world operated like everybody else does. And so I in my mind, I made this mental box, and I put all of those things in it that I didn't understand, and I put the word unknown, and I decided that I would never know what happened, but that I was going to act like the world was like it was before all of this began, because I was happier then, because now I had lost my girlfriend, my thoughts didn't, I lost my job, I was living with my parents, and my thoughts didn't work right anymore. And that day, I started to get better rapidly. So my mom was pushing me to go to work, and so I went to Voc Rehab, and I had hoped that they would like send me to training or school, but you know, I got a master's degree and a pretty decent work history, so they just made me get dressed up every day and show up like I was going to work and look for work. And so I thought, well, shit, if I have to do that, I might as well get a job. And my mom handed me a newspaper and had circled this group home. And I got a job at a group home like I had been doing 10 years before, making about the same amount of money. And so I worked at the group home, worked midnights. I only had one coworker. And as I continued to put my thoughts together and save up enough money to buy a beater car, and I worked there for a few months, and then I got a job as a family's first worker, my first social work job, and I went to my case manager and I said, hey man, I got a job kind of like what you have. I think it would be a good idea. Oh, and you know, as I was on meds And I was on this, they added this Depakote, this mood stabilizer, and it kind of messed up my poops, and I felt like it slowed my thinking, and they took a level, and it wasn't at therapeutic levels, and the doctor wanted to raise it. And I said, no, I don't think so. I'm feeling better now. And there's this classic pattern of people with bipolar disorder who get stabilized on meds, don't like the side effects, go off their meds, and then have a manic breakdown again, and it gets worse, and bad things happen. And so I know that's what he was thinking. But he said that, well, you have a very serious mental illness, and you're never going to get better. And that was devastating to me. But I knew there was no court order. I didn't have to take the meds. And so I just said it was hard, but I knew it was my decision. I just said, well, I'm still not going to take more Depakote. And so when I came back and he saw that I was still stable, he's like, well, let's get rid of the Depakote because it's not at a stable level. And I came back and I was still doing good. And he's like, well, let's reduce the Risperidol. And then I came back and he's like, well, let's take you off the Risperidol. And I managed. I had a whole set of tools that I would use to manage both when I was depressed. And the biggest thing, though, is going back to sociology. I think I talked about this idea of status and master status. Most people organize that they are from their job, but people with mental illness think of themselves as mentally ill. I'm a schizophrenic. I'm a bipolar. I'm borderline. And I knew that that was dangerous. And so I thought of myself, who was someone who was struggling with symptoms of bipolar disorder, that I didn't always have them. I wasn't always going to have them. And it wasn't who I was. I'm a good person who has symptoms of bipolar disorder right now. And I think that protected me, because I don't know of anyone who is so shattered and severe psychiatric symptoms who pulled themselves together and then went on to have a regular life. And so I did. And I still struggle with mood stuff, but I have a whole array of mechanisms to manage it and to bring it on when I need that. And so the quest after this period in life was how to integrate all of those experiences. And I harvested those ideas and things that appeared delusional and insane at the time. I knew things were different when poems that I couldn't get anybody to listen to because nobody wants to listen to a crazy person. And the same poem I read at a poetry slam in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and I won, and they gave me a crystal dish and a check for $25 for the same words that they wouldn't listen to from a crazy person, but from a poet in a coffee shop was worthy of a cash prize.